I'd like to call the Transportation Finance Committee to order. We don't have a quorum as yet, and we have a few people that are excused, and we have a few people that called in late, so we probably will... We'll just temporarily, when we have a quorum, we'll approve the minutes. But for the time being, I guess we can't take any official action, but we can move the bill and start the hearing process. And the vice chair is absent today, and I have the bill that's up, for the first one that's up, so I will move House File 73, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, House File 73, to recommend the pass and send to the Finance Division, and, or Finance Committee, right. And we have some testifiers from the Department of Aviation or Aeronautics. But the bill deals, I'd just like to talk about the bill. The bill deals with transferring some money back to the Aeronautics Fund, which was transferred in the last session from the General Fund to help balance the budget. And we recognize that there's a budget situation now, but at least if there are going to be any actions taken in the budget, I think we have to be considered to take a look at that money that was taken out of the fund, which shouldn't have, well, I shouldn't say shouldn't have been, but which was actually part of their dedicated fund to a degree, and then transferred back. If we couldn't, that action wouldn't be taken here. It would be taken in the division. It amounted to $15 million, which was transferred in the last session. And we have some testifiers on behalf of the bill, and I will be staying here, Mr. Hoff and Mr. Kroll.
Yes.
Kroll? Would you come to the... Are you going to testify, sir?
Yes.
If you would, you can come to the witness stand. Oh, excuse me, before you start, I have to do a reading again. The House requests that all wireless communications devices be turned off during hearings. These devices interfere with the audio in the room and the official audio recording of the meeting. And last meeting, even though I read it, we had to send the pages out to turn five people's cell phones off. And this is being read in each committee because it does interfere. We keep the transcribe the records on the computer, so anyone that has a cell phone, be certain it's turned all the way off, not just on buzzing. Okay. Or any electronic device, apparently. Except your heart monitor. Mr. Kroll, welcome to the committee, and Mr. Hoff.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Kroll. I am the aviation director at SuperValue. I noticed that you spelled it with an E, and we're a thrifty company. There's no E on the end of SuperValue. I'm here today representing the membership of the Minnesota Business Aircraft Association as a board member. My day job has me managing the flight department of a Fortune 100 company based here in Minneapolis. I'm also a pilot and end user of the Great Minnesota Airport System. First, I'd like to speak to you as a member of the Board of Directors at the MBAA. Minnesota Business Aircraft Association currently has over 400 members, which includes pilots, flight attendants, mechanics, avionic technicians, schedulers, dispatchers, aircraft manufacturers, fixed base operators, insurance companies, and other companies that provide services to business aviation. The 130 plus companies our membership represents actively use the Minnesota airport system in support of their businesses. And they have a vested interest in maintaining the current system and improving our airports as new technologies become available. Companies like Target, who uses 17 airports out of the metro area to support their operations at other Target stores. Places like Schwan's Corporation, who constantly bring people into the airline services. And of course, Marvin Windows, who uses the airport on a daily basis to bring its customers to its manufacturing base. As an aviation director, I have the privilege of overseeing the corporate flight department based in three different states. My company uses these tools, these business tools, to reach 2,400 retail locations, 500 independent customers, and multiple hotel distribution centers. I know firsthand how great the Minnesota airport system is because my company has many retail outlets and independent customers all over the state. I also understand, as a user of the system, someone has to pay for it. What is hard to explain to our management is the fact that it costs $300 to register a Citation 7 in Boise, Idaho, and $51,000 for the same aircraft in Minnesota. I explain that the money goes directly to the State Airport Fund to maintain the great system of airports in Minnesota. Well, I used to be able to say that. The fact of the matter is that the fund has been taken twice in the last 5 years. Is it too much to ask that the $185,000 collected from our company, that it goes to support the Minnesota airport system that it was intended for? I don't think it is. Finally, as a pilot, I can tell you that aviation is built on trust. My passengers trust that our equipment matches the mission and it is maintained to the highest standards every single day. They trust that I have trained well, I've done all my pre-flight planning and briefing, that I even have good rest and I'm physically fit and able to do the mission, and most of all, that I'm going to get them safely to their destination and back home. I trust that the system I operate in is the best that it can be, from the air traffic controllers to the person changing the runway light bulb. It is hard to fully explain with words what it's like to break out of the clouds on an instrument approach. When you're flying at night and you shoot the approach down to 200 feet and break out, you have no idea what a relief it is to see a brightly lit runway, clear of obstructions, and with the depth perception of a painted center line, so you know that you can make a safe landing. That doesn't always happen. I trust that the airport manager has plowed the snow to the full width of the runway, and that the reflective paint stripe on the runway center line is giving me the visual cues I need to make a smooth landing. We all need the entire system to work all the time. We need to trust each other. The problem now is that through the actions of our government, the trust has been broken. We do not need more dialogue or studying of this issue. We need to have the designated funds collected for the airport system returned. And we need to make sure that the state airport system does not fall victim to another budget shortfall again. I do understand, because we all over budgets, the difficult situation that the $5 billion plus deficit is going to bring. But you must understand that aviation is risk adverse. Not completing the simplest of tasks, including just painting the runway center stripe, removing snowbanks from the ends of the runway so we don't clip it with our wingtips, filling cracks in the runway so we don't get foreign object damage in our engines, or maintaining just the current navigation aids can have a catastrophic consequence. I hope that you understand my company and my colleagues from the Minnesota Business Aircraft Association are relying on you to restore their trust by returning and protecting the State Airports Fund. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Carl. If you could stay there for a minute.
Sure.
We have a quorum, and I'd like to call the committee to order. And so we can take some action on the bill afterwards. Will someone move the minutes? I think you've got a chance to read. I forgot Newton. Representative Newton, that's correct. Representative Newton moved the minutes of the last meeting, I forgot the date in it, of January 15th. Mm-hmm. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
I forgot there. Any questions or comments, sir? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Are there questions for Mr. Crowell? Mr. Crowell, you really did a great job in explaining this. For some of our, we have a pilot member here, and one of our pilot members is being a little bit late, but Representative Seaver said, don't you have any questions? If not, I will ask some questions. You have a question, or a witness?
I did.
Excuse me,
Mr. Chair. You had mentioned that you wanted to have us review so that we could take action on this bill. Are you saying that we're going to be voting on something today?
That's correct. Do forward it on to committee to the next committee. That's basically.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I know that in 2003, when this first came out of the budget, it was taken, and it was taken with the promise that we would see it in the future when the budget situation improved. We did momentarily, I think we even saw a glimpse of it as it passed through the treasury and went back into the 1812 and then was lost in the myth again. But I think there's a very appropriate statement that was made in particular to the airport and our the urgency of maintaining our facilities at our airports is one of our vital economic development tools, and it is a trust issue because these monies were taken from things like licensures, from being able to store the vehicles to the whole nine yards on the aviation side, and I think it's the right thing to do. So I would speak strongly in favor of this in terms of keeping our trust with the aviation industry in Minnesota.
Thank you. Rifkin Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I had the opportunity to speak with the association last week, and Mr. Huff and the airport managers throughout the area did a wonderful job of explaining the needs of the small airports throughout the state. So I appreciate your testimony. We also heard from other businesses talk about the importance of multimodal transportation and facilitating business throughout the state. So I think, Representative Stevenson, we heard this message and the need to restore the funding loud and clear, and also to prepare, if there is federal recovery money, to talk about the ability or the lack of ability to meet any type of matches for that funding. So Representative Beard was there as well, spoke highly of this need as well. So I'm thankful for the bill and for the testimony today.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Morrow? Or Morgan, not Morrow. We just finished him.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krall, do you have any sense of specifically what would happen between now and, say, the end of the session that makes this so time sensitive? What are the dangers? What are the concerns specifically that you have that we need to make this transfer now?
There are projects that have been slated to complete that were not able to be completed, and other projects, for instance, the navigation aid in Bemidji. It gets somewhat complicated, but for instance, the VOR that needs to be rebuilt or restored, that delay process puts us in a position when we have to land at that airport. If the wind's coming from a westerly direction, we can't shoot the approach to the lower minimums. And so it makes landing with a tailwind another judgment call that the pilot has to make, and it puts you in a position of going, you know, is this really worth the decision, or do you scrap this leg of the trip and go on to the next leg? So there's critical things, and it's hard to say, well, what will the consequences be, because the smallest of issues can end up having a big effect depending on what happens. I remember one time in traveling at a different state where early morning we got up to depart from the runway at an airport, and the airport manager's snowblower had broken down, and he had left these 5-foot windrows just right on the edge of the runway, but we couldn't see that was a fact until we got a third of the way down the runway. And so at that moment you're thinking, how close, you know, are my wingtips to this snow removal? So the people who put in funding for used equipment, it just goes on and on and on. Simple things like repairing the cracks in runways. Is that going to be critical? It isn't if something doesn't happen, but we've also known that things can happen. So it's hard to know. I mean, there are some funding projects that I think everybody is looking at very closely at the state and saying we have to prioritize these monies. But, you know, the funding comes in for the state at certain key times. So when the airline property tax is paid and all of us pay our registration fees, there's an amount of money that's yet to be appropriated and used. And it seems like that looks like such a big target, even though it's about to be let in construction bids and ready to go actively in use. So we're fearful that same thing could happen again. So I just think that our communication is that we can't have the money taken again, and we need to get some of these projects that have been put on hold to be implemented and completed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this airport fund is funded in entirely out of user fees, people who use the services?
That's correct. There's a fuel tax, there's a registration tax, and there's a flight line property tax.
Thank you. Representative Severs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps you can tell us about how much project has been put aside. You know, do we have a dollar figure on how much has been set aside in waiting?
Can you answer that, Gordon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, we had a snapshot from the Minnesota Office of Aeronautics back in June, and you have that list in your materials today. And it showed 41 projects that were, you know, most of them were construction, zoning, some were for equipment. But at that time, $9.3 million roughly, along with the local match of $14 million, would have resulted in $32 million of the airport activity or construction activity or purchases of equipment, as Mr. Kral pointed out, for snow blowing and things like that. So these projects, outside of the one there mentioned, Duluth, that did move forward with their project, on an, but I think it was scaled back to some degree. The airport manager for Duluth is here today and could speak to that some more directly, but these 41 projects are sitting in the holding pattern for the most part.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Was there any federal funds that weren't used because of that, Mr. Hoff?
None that I'm aware of, no.
Representative Reinhart?
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to hit on a couple points. And one of those, as Representative Morgan was asking his questions, I think it's important for us to consider the sources that these revenues come from. They are exclusively user-generated. And secondly, I think it was Representative Moore who made the point about being prepared for any possible federal stimulus that might be coming down the road. But thirdly, members, just for your consideration, you know, this is airports across greater Minnesota are vital for transportation, but they're also incredibly vital for economic development. You know, I happen to be from a community with Mr. Price here that is the home of Cirrus Aviation, and we're the home of Cirrus Aviation in part because of labor force, but in large part because of having a vital, well-improved, well-maintained airport, and one that is progressively moving along. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for bringing this forward, and you'll have my complete support on it.
Any further questions? Mr. Hoff, are there other people who want to testify?
I would just like to add that the Association of Minnesota Counties and the League of Minnesota Cities support this legislation, and they have put it into their legislative platforms. And, of course, they all recognize the importance of their local communities, as you've heard people say about how they are an economic stimulus to the local community. If for the record, the League of Minnesota did have their 2009 policy airport planning and funding, if you would like to submit, include that.
I appreciate the fact that you have that list of projects, because that's one thing that I was going to ask. And they actually, were they just deferrals, or basically were they potential projects that were going to just a program, or were they basically deferrals?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question, Mr.
Chair. Did you anticipate they were going to be all built this year?
Or yes.
Future. Oh, okay.
And Mr. Workman, the office director for aeronautics, is in the audience too. It was my understanding that these were all scheduled to go forward in 2009.
No further questions. Mr. Kral, thank you very much for your
testimony. Thank you for your time.
Appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
And does anyone else want to testify in the audience? If not, the chair renews his motion that House File 73 be recommended to pass and sent to the transportation or the finance committee, not division. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? House File 73 has been passed and will be sent to the finance committee. Thank you. And the next, we'll have an overview of the Department of Public Safety and the Driver and Vehicle Services account. Commissioner Campion, are you the testifier?
Good
Good afternoon, Mr. Hello. Chair. Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. I'm here to give an overview of two of the four agencies within the Department of Public Safety which this division has jurisdiction over, the Office of Traffic Safety and the Office of Pipeline Safety. Colonel Martinansky from the State Colonel of the State Patrol will be here to give an overview of the Minnesota State Patrol, and Pat McCormick, the Director of Driving Vehicle Services, will give an overview of DVS. The Office of Pipeline Safety has a mission to protect the lives, property, and the environment through implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident, and incident investigations, and education. There are 17 full-time equivalents in the Office of Pipeline Safety. Elizabeth Skelnick is the Chief Administrative Engineer and runs the division. There's a $2.2 million, give or take, budget in during a particular fiscal year. About $1,200,000 is derived from special revenue funds, and about $980,000 comes in from federal grants. The special revenue fund is derived from inspection fees and evacuation damage prevention penalties. There is a number of activities in the Office of Pipeline Safety. They do pipeline inspections and investigations. They perform any number of educational and enforcement activities. And they also run the Gopher One call line, which most everyone here in Minnesota is certainly familiar with. The Office of Pipeline Safety in Minnesota has an excellent reputation with the U.S. Department of Office Pipeline Safety, the federal office, and the Gopher One line really has, in the past years, been a model for the rest of the country. The Office of Traffic Safety has a mission to lead efforts to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries by changing human behavior on Minnesota's highways. Cherie Marty is the director of the Office of Traffic Safety and has 20 full-time equivalents. The Office of Traffic Safety has about a $27 million budget. $435,000 comes from trunk highway money from the legislature. The rest of the $27 million is leveraged with that trunk highway money, and that money comes from various federal grant sources. The vast majority of the money that comes in the Office of Traffic Safety goes out to local units of government, which people on this committee and certainly the rest of the legislature represent. So local units of government are the recipients of the vast majority of the money that Office of Traffic Safety gets. Over the last couple of years, just a comment or two, with the passage of graduated driver's license and point-OA legislation passed by this body and the legislature, the Office of Traffic Safety and all of its participating agencies, whether it's law enforcement and other traffic safety agents and organizations, have seen a dramatic increase in fatalities on Minnesota highways. We had a 16% reduction in traffic fatalities in 2008 over 2007. There will be some additional fatalities that will be tallied as the next month or so goes on, but it's a very significant reduction. In 2007, there were 500 fatalities. In 2007, there was something like 435. So it's a terrific accomplishment, and it's a tribute to all of our partners throughout the state of Minnesota and all the rest of the people who work in the traffic safety department. So with that, Mr. Chair, the only other thing that I would comment is that I think people in the traffic safety business profession really do know what works, what has effective outcomes. It's enforcement and education. It's focusing in on those demographics who in this our fatality rate here in Minnesota are represented disproportionately by young people, 17, 18, 19, but some 20, mid-20s of age who die and are involved in life-altering crashes on our highways throughout the entire state. And primary seatbelt, again, will be one of the centerpiece legislations that the Office of Traffic Safety and the Department of Public Safety will try to pass this legislative session. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I answer any questions that you might have.
Any question? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you.
I've got a question. This revolves on pipeline safety, and it involves an issue called farm tax.
My understanding, and this is something I've had some contact with constituents about, and it involves individuals in farms usually that have been allowed to tap into a pipeline to use gas, and then they put in their own pipe and pay for it. The problem is there's no recorded record of where that is, and now we have contractors coming in that want to dig through whatever, and there's no other than the fact that the tap exists and they're billed for the gas they use. You know, the property changes hands or whatever, and there's no record of where this pipe is. Now we got contractors following through and not knowing where this pipeline, and Gopher State Wind Call doesn't apparently know about that. And I'm wondering about your thoughts about that, if you've talked about it, if you looked at it. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Deamer, Elizabeth Selnick is here, the two things here I mentioned, and we'll be more than happy to answer the question.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Elizabeth Selnick, and I'm the Chief Engineer for the Office of Pipeline Safety. I'm also here representing Jerry Rosendahl, who's our Director and also the State Fire Marshal. Thank you for your question. This is a question that has come up quite often lately. There seems to be quite a lot of interest in this issue. The problem is that these are private facilities owned by whoever the farmer is or the landowner. So any private facility in Minnesota, whether it be in your backyard going out to your barbecue or a farm tap going to a farmer's facility, are owned by private citizens. Therefore, we, the Office of Pipeline Safety, have no regulatory authority over private property. We only regulate transportation. This is a transportation committee. And the definition of pipelines and our regulatory authority comes from the transportation element of that. So we don't have authority over private facilities. There could be some rulemaking done here in Minnesota to try to give us some authority and to force people to join the one-call system. I know contractors in particular are very nervous about this issue because they go to do some work and they think everything is marked, but it's not. Now, there's great information on the Gopher State One Call website to tell people about private facilities and to make sure that anyone who's doing work, presumably if you're doing work for a farmer, that farmer should know that there's a pipeline on his property. And if it's the original owner, they should know roughly where it is. I know that there's some interest in maybe doing something with real estate laws and transfers to try to make the best information possible, but there's definitely some work to be done there, and that would take a lot of commitment to get that passed, because I can tell you that the history of private owners giving up any rights over their property is not good.
Representative Emmer, follow up.
Thank you. I think that addressed that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just have one trivia question that's the best one in public safety, and that is, how many miles of liquid and gas pipeline zigzag the state of Minnesota that the Office of Pipeline Safety has responsibility for? It's a wild guess.
Is it on the paper? Probably is, isn't it?
66,000 miles of pipeline, gas and liquid pipeline that zigzag the state of Minnesota.
And that's actually anything from an inch and a half to, 24? Mm-hmm. What's your biggest size?
I think we have some, we may have some five, no, I don't think we have any 5 foot here, but we've definitely got some 3 to 4 foot pipes in Minnesota.
Is that crude? What comes in that?
Mostly it's crude in those sizes. But we do actually have some 3 foot gas, the Alliance pipeline that traverses the state, that's a transmission pipeline. I think those are in the 3 to 4 foot range.
Representative Demmer.
Mr. Chair, would we have about 56,600 miles?
He can read. Good for you.
Mr. Chair, Colonel Ganaski will be next, and followed by Pat McCormick from Driver Vehicle Services.
Okay. You're going to be available, Commissioner?
I will be, Mr. Chair, yes.
Thanks for the hint and where to look, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner? Colonel.
Appreciate the thought, Mr. Chair. My name is Colonel Mark Danaski. I'm the Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol, representing the men and women of that organization. I will give you a very brief overview of the State Patrol today. We did give out a handoff packet that has a lot of the little facts that people like to know and understand about some of our operations from last year. Last week, I had the privilege of testifying before Senator Murphy's Transportation Committee in the Senate. And at that time, we had just gone through one of those bitterly cold days. And we suffered a number of crashes across the state of Minnesota. And just for representative's sake, I thought I would ask our dispatch center to give me some numbers. And over a 36-hour period, just prior to my testimony up there, the State Patrol responded to a little over 900 crashes. 730 of them were property damage. About 100 were personal injury damages. We responded to over 700 vehicles off the roadway, 250 motorist assists, a number of driving complaints, and assisted a number of agencies. And that was on a day when the weather was poor, and clearly we did a lot of work out there in those days. But just to put it into context of what a normal weekend would look like, and that's what we had over this past long weekend, the past 4 days, including a holiday. Over the past four-day reporting period, the Minnesota State Patrol responded to 618 property damage crashes. Interestingly enough, 214 of them were rollovers. So about a third of the crashes that we responded to were rollovers of vehicles. 127 personal injury crashes. We did have two fatal crashes this past weekend, resulting in three fatalities. We had 743 vehicles off the roadway, 248 driving complaints, 592 motorist assists, 141 assists to other agencies. Now, we arrested 70 driving while intoxicated individuals, and we took 7 individuals into custody on arrest warrants. It just gives you kind of a flavor of what the State Patrol is doing on a day-to-day basis. It doesn't come without some potential for harm as well. Since December 1st of just this past year, so in other words, in about a month and three quarters, we've had 26 of our cruisers rear-ended, several of them total losses, two troopers hospitalized for short periods of time. This tends to be a trend that we seem to be increasing. The squad car sitting alongside the shoulder of the highway getting struck. That despite the fact that the legislature was wise enough to pass a move over law some time ago, and people are trying to do that. But unfortunately, particularly during winters like this, when we have poor weather conditions, sometimes these things happen. I would address the fact sheet very briefly and draw your attention just a couple of important items. I think, first of all, what is foremost during these times in particular is our operating budget. Under funding, you see that the Minnesota State Patrol operates on an annual operating budget of approximately $82 million. And if you move further back into your packet, on page 5, I believe it is, on page 5, we have a couple of graphs that basically explain where the funding appropriations come from this body, and where the Minnesota State Patrol spends the majority of its funds. As you can see, the vast majority, nearly 80% of the funding allocated for the Minnesota State Patrol goes for salaries and benefits. The other thing that I would draw your attention to, and I'll just make a few comments regarding it, is on the bottom of the front page, several years ago, the Minnesota State Patrol set about a strategic planning process. And during that process, we developed 4 overarching goals for our organization, and we based all of our decisions on those 4 strategic overarching goals. The first one clearly is the reduction of deaths, injuries, property damage, and life-changing events on Minnesota's roadways. And as Commissioner Champion pointed out, we would like to think that we did play a part in last year's significant reduction in fatalities on our highways. As the Commissioner said, we saw a nearly 16% reduction, which is phenomenal. And we suspect that as the data comes out, you'll also find that corresponding property damage and personal injury crashes will also show reduction. But to give you some idea of what we've done in that area to help facilitate that, over the past year and a half, the Minnesota State Patrol has taken on a significant emphasis on seatbelt compliance. It's our feeling that regardless of what this body comes forward with on a primary seatbelt, we do have a law out there, and the Minnesota State Patrol is committed to enforcing that law. We put an emphasis on that. I think that our 87% compliance in the state reflects the idea that not only the Minnesota State Patrol, but local jurisdictions are taking the enforcement prospect as well as education. As the Commissioner said, education is a key component of a good traffic safety program. In addition to that, the Minnesota State Patrol has taken the process of deploying our personnel, even as far as where they're stationed, and the times that they're stationed, places, what we're doing, what we're looking for, and why we're out there. In other words, we take a look at our crash data and we find out what's causing, what are the causational factors for crashes, what time of the day are they happening, where are they happening, and we're trying to direct our activity in those areas. We're rescheduling people, we're deploying people in different places at different times. An example of that, where we have a collaborative effort with MnDOT, is, as you're probably aware, in the last couple of years we had a program called HEAT, which is an intensified speed enforcement program. It was based upon the idea that MnDOT could gather data across the state from their traffic loops so they could find out what time of day and how fast the cars are going in certain areas of the state, and then we deployed resources to those particular areas. Phenomenally successful program. They worked very well. The unfortunate part about it was that MnDOT only has so many loops out there, and they're quite expensive to put onto the roadways or over the roadways. And particularly in the winter time, if you put a loop over it, it can be scraped up by snowplows. With MnDOT, we've come up, there's a new piece of technology out there that is a sort of a small plate that's about 12 inches long by about 8 inches wide. And it's just a small computer that you can put on in the middle of the roadway. And what we do with MnDOT now is we place it out on the roadways for a series of 48 or 72 hours, and we can gather data for all that period of time. We come back and plug it into a computer, and it'll tell us how many cars went over that particular plate, what time of day they were going over, and what their speeds were. In that way, what we can do is we can look at specific areas of highways and once again direct their activities to those places and locations where we're going to be most effective out there. So we're looking at technology as a way of increasing our effectiveness as well. We are working closely with the Office of Traffic Safety, with the counties, and with the local jurisdictions. I echo, I think, something that Commissioner Campion said. The great traffic fatality rate, the lowering of the traffic fatality rate, I think, has come about because a lot of jurisdictions are seeing traffic safety as being public safety. And they're taking steps to encourage traffic safety in their local communities. And to that end, we've worked closely with them as well. We have a number of programs, which I'm sure these committee members have heard, Safe and Sober, Predator Ticket, Project Nightcap, Keep. They're all collaborative efforts between the Minnesota State Patrol, local jurisdictions, and county sheriff's offices, kind of bringing all of our forces together at times and places when we feel we can have the most effect out there. One of the other strategic goals that we have out there is to maximize service to the public and provide assistance to our allied agencies. We do that, as I mentioned before, and you heard a number of agencies that we responded to that we back up and support. It is becoming more and more reality that each one of our organizations, whether it's the Minnesota State Patrol, the Sheriff's Office, or local police department, can't do everything on their own. And so we are starting more and more to rely on local agencies assisting us, and conversely, local agencies are calling on us to assist them at times when they're short-staffed as well. And again, that cooperative effort is working very well. And then lastly, I'll just touch on what I think is important this year in particular as we all face, look at the budget situation and the challenges that face all state agencies and local jurisdictions, and that is resources and what we're doing. You can probably see on our third strategic goal is to effectively acquire and strategically deploy resources while enhancing organizational efficiency. So some of those steps, we have looked at our organization, and I'm proud to say that the Minnesota State Patrol will be celebrating its 80th anniversary next year. And we actually are going through a lot of changes that are going to make our organization look significantly different than it has in the recent past. At the Commissioner of Public Safety's direction, the Minnesota State Patrol has taken on a research project to look at our PSAPs, our 911 centers, what we refer to as our traffic operations centers. We currently have 10 across the state of Minnesota. We have a study underway right now that is moving forward that will look at consolidating those 911 centers from something from 10 to something less and still be able to support the responses and the effective service that we have to the public. We're also looking at the metropolitan area. Now, we have two districts down here. We have a West Metro District and an East Metro District of the State Patrol providing services. We're looking at consolidation of the two metropolitan areas and combining those areas into one large metropolitan area, including some efficiency of scale in providing that project. Our training academy, which has been located at the MnDOT facility at Arden Hills for as long as I can remember, over 30 years, because that's when I went through it, is in the process right now of moving up to Camp Ripley. We currently provide our basic training at Camp Ripley, and we do a significant amount of our annual ongoing training at Camp Ripley. In conjunction with MnDOT, as you're well aware, DNR has their facilities up there. The National Guard is up there. There's a project going on now with the Department of Homeland Security to build an emergency operations center up there. There's some synergy being involved in putting some state agencies up there in conjunction with the National Guard. We are now in the process of moving our training academy and all the personnel up there to that location. Fleet management, as you're probably aware, the Department of Administration put out a program last couple of years called M5, a computerized program that takes our fleets and allows us an opportunity to look at basically how much it costs to operate a car per mile. So we can take a closer look at who's using gas, who's going through too many brakes, who's not changing the oil on time. And as trivial as it sounds, it's unbelievable when you start paying attention to little things like that. All of a sudden, you're not blowing up engines at 60,000 miles and you're not losing transmissions at 75,000 miles. And each one of those costs $3,000 or $4,000. And although it's early in the process, I have no doubt that down the road it's going to pay off significantly in how we manage our fleet and how we can take care of that. Along that line, clearly the price of vehicles has gone up, and as Mr. Chair is aware, Most of our funding for our cruisers comes out of a fee that's attached to the title transfer in the state of Minnesota. Unfortunately, on the graph, you see those lines going in opposite direction. So we buy less and less cars every year. So probably this year, we're trading our cars in currently at about 100,000 miles. We anticipate that the trade-in will go up significantly if we trade them in at all. There might be the potential we just keep the cars until they run out and they're done with because they have little retail value any longer out on the open market. We are looking at other cost savings. I know I'm cognizant of your time. I'll keep it at that. The Minnesota State Patrol is looking at a number of areas to incorporate cost savings and to make our job more efficient. One of the last things, I guess it doesn't mean a lot, except for just as an example of some of the things that we're doing, is you're probably aware the State Patrol provides the majority of the aviation services for law enforcement in the state of Minnesota. We currently have 9 aircraft. We are in the process of selling 2 of those aircraft in order to consolidate our fleet. We still feel that we can provide an adequate service for the rest of law enforcement, but under the current economic conditions, we feel that the diversity of 2 of those aircraft at this time is prudent for our organization as well as for the state of Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would be willing to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Always your compliment, Colonel. Are you up to complimenting?
Mr. Chair, that would be fine. Thank you.
Beg your pardon?
We are currently running a school. We have a school in progress right now. We really don't have a complement, sir. The number of personnel that we have, the number of FTEs that we have, is dependent upon the funding that we have in the biennium. So consequently, when we receive our funding from the legislature, that is what we have over the period of time. As an example that I gave to the Senate, we may have 550 people today, but the price of gas, we go through approximately 1 million gallons of gas a year. And so if the price of gas is $2 a gallon, it costs us $2 million. If the price of gas goes up $1, it costs $3 million. If it goes up to $4, it's $4 million. Well, that $2 million that it costs more in fuel has got to come from someplace. And really the only place that can come from, as you saw in our budget oversight, is personnel. And so if I have a $2 million shortfall in fuel, it has to come out of the number of FTEs that I have. And so our number of personnel we have will fluctuate depending upon the other number of budgetary issues that I have to deal with.
You really don't have part-time help, though, do you? They have to be troopers.
Yes. Yes, sir. That's correct.
So in other words, you just send them home.
Well, we don't send anybody home. We just, over the course of the year, Mr. Chair, say this upcoming biennium. If we don't have adequate budgeting, if the budget isn't adequate to sustain the number of troopers that we have, as troopers retire and as they leave our force, we just don't replace them. We just hold those FTE positions open.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, last year, I believe it was, that we passed the school bus inspection legislation. Mm-hmm. Could you give us an update of how that's progressing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it is going very well. As a matter of fact, that report, the initial report on that unit was submitted to the commissioner's office at the end of last week. Completed their initial report with their recommendations and where they have. We brought on the new director of pupil transportation. That's a trooper by the name of Lieutenant Ed Carroll. He's taken over, and they're moving forward with the hiring and the deployment of the personnel associated with that. And I expect that sometime very shortly, either in this committee or somewhere shortly down the road, you'll see a greater overview of that particular unit.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering and curious, you know, with the high price of gasoline last summer, if you noticed the decline, because they were saying, you know, nationwide that driving habits, you know, changed. I know I drove a whole lot less. Just wondering and curious if that had an effect on any of your statistics for accidents and that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I suspect that when the statistics come in, obviously we're a little behind. It's only January, and our statistics are coming in from the end of last year. But we will see, my thoughts are that we will see a reduction in the amount of vehicle miles traveled in the state, or at least it will stay steady. Interestingly enough, there are some people out there, some troopers out there, will tell you that they've also seen a change in driving habits. I think that those individuals that are probably a little more fiscally conservative probably drove a little closer to the speed limit, if not slower. Unfortunately, there are still individuals out there that are really not concerned with the price of gas and still drive kind of odd.
Thank you.
Colonel, how about, do you still have a fraud unit, and what's happening with it?
Mr. Chair, you know, we do... I would hate to call it a fraud unit because it has been literally reduced to one individual. The individual is still out there, but I will tell you that as part of our metro consolidation plan, it's very difficult for us to maintain the number of staffing that we had at one time. As you're well aware, Mr. Chair, that at one time was staffed with four individuals, I believe, on its high point. What we've done is, what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to take that knowledge from that individual and bring him together with other investigators in the metropolitan area and across the state, so that we not only have that one individual that has expertise in vehicle fraud and taxation fraud, but try to share that knowledge amongst a number of investigators in the organization so we can kind of diversify and keep that program rolling as long as we can. I think, Mr. Chair, frankly, at times now where taxation fraud is probably going to rise again because people, you know, for various reasons are not going to want to pay, you know, for the tabs or do some other things on the dealer side as well, that we do want to keep a focus on, that we do want to keep watching that, but I think that it might be in a little different form than it was of a formal unit before, and really roll it more into the investigative section of the organization.
You used to have some cases pending. Is that, they're actually caught up, or are you pretty much caught up?
Mr. Chair, I think they are pretty much caught up. Unfortunately, as the number of people went down, so did the number of cases that were coming through. We still do receive a significant number of referrals from other organizations. As you're probably aware, a title fraud and those type of things take kind of a specialized knowledge. And so when people come across some of those issues, they're referred to the State Patrol. And that one investigator we have handles them. But we really would like to diversify his knowledge amongst a larger group of people so we could expand that program.
Representative Swale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, I'm just curious about the enforcement of truck weights, and I'm wondering, have you had difficulty in, maintaining staff in order to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, frankly, our staffing, as I think on the report says, we're up to 71 commercial vehicle inspectors, and we actually have a class of 9 in right now, thanks to this body and the body last year, when we came through and we had a request for fuel supplements and other things that allowed us to continue to move forward, one of our priorities was to bring the core of commercial vehicle inspectors back up to a level that we felt would be adequate to do just that. Much like the question that Representative Leader posed earlier about the fraud, the Minnesota State Patrol, a lot of times is seen as a public safety agency, and we talk a lot about fatalities and personal injury. We also recognize that there is taxation fraud that is happening out on our transportation system. We should have something to do with it. To your point and to your question, clearly the infrastructure is crumbling. It's one of the issues that's the forefront of the national topic. And part of the reason that it's crumbling is because we have people that are taking excessive loads and running these trucks illegally across these highways. And so we have kind of rededicated ourselves to looking at that process, and we're putting out these vehicle inspectors. We will see a difference in the State Patrol in that we no longer are counting so heavily on our fixed sites. At one time, we had 6 sites all over the place, and we had them staffed 24 hours a day. Well, it's a very mobile society now with communications and everything else, and it doesn't take a whole lot for a truck to understand that our scale site over by Hudson is activated, and you just go up the highway someplace and come across the river somewhere else. So what we've done now is we have mobile units. We have mobile units working directly with troopers, and they'll go to one spot and they'll stay until they hear on the radios and the communication going out that they've been made, basically, and they pick up their toys and move someplace else. So we were doing a much better job, and I will go again back to the collaboration with local organizations. We've also, some of the counties have taken this on as well because they understand the crisis is also on their roads, and counties like Hennepin and Ramsey have taken a truck lane to New Heights as well and worked very closely with those organizations on saturations and programs. So I'm very happy to say, Representative, that we are moving forward, and I think we are doing a good job, or we're trying to move forward to do a good, better job on the truck lane issue.
Any further questions? No. Thank you, Colonel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And we also have provided you with a fact sheet, and I'd like to just highlight some of those provisions on the fact sheet. First of all, as you know, the mission of Driver and Vehicle Services is to provide fair, accurate, secure, and timely service to our customers. We use the acronym FAST. And we do that through effect providing effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for our staff and business partners. We have a budget of approximately $45 million on an annual basis, and we generate and collect about $1.1 billion in revenue on behalf of the state. Our budget is made up of the special revenue fund, the driver license special revenue account, and vehicle services special revenue account. Both of those accounts are made up of the fees that we collect in processing driver license and motor vehicle transactions. And we also received $7 million from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund to pay for plate production. We have about approximately a little over 512 employees. We are located in 98 locations throughout the state. That includes 95 exam stations, our town square operation in downtown St. Paul, and we have two vehicle inspection sites that are full-time in operation. One is in St. Paul on Como Avenue, and the other one is in Royalton. Our vehicle services program area administers vehicle registration and title programs, and in 2007 we issued over 1.5 vehicles and processed about 4.3 million vehicle registrations. We have approximately 173 deputy officers that are located throughout the state that provide motor vehicle services to our customers. And we also license and regulate about 3,800 dealers in Minnesota. We are responsible for approximately 6.4 million vehicle ownership and registration records. And we also work with dealer licensing and inspection, and also assist in the detection of vehicle theft through inspection of salvage, reconstructed, and specially assembled vehicles. Our ProRate office administers the International Registration and Fuel Tax Agreements. These are agreements provide for uniform collection of registration and fuel taxes throughout the U.S. and Canada, and we collect registration fuel taxes that are due from motor carriers and distribute those taxes not only within Minnesota but to all other member jurisdictions. There are approximately 6,800 Minnesota-based trucking companies. We also audit 3% of the carrier base to ensure that proper payments are being made. In driver services, we're responsible for the evaluation and licensing and examination of drivers, and we've issued last year approximately 1.68 million cards, and we maintain over 4 million driving records. We operate at 95 exam stations, as well as application renewal services are provided at 125 driver license agent offices. We license 117 commercial driver education schools and over 550 driver education instructors. We also approve 265 public school driver education programs, 25 accident prevention courses, 6 moped courses, and 28 DWI clinics. Over the past year, we conducted over 600,000 knowledge tests, and we also evaluate drivers in terms of compliance and interview and correspond with over 100,000 drivers on an annual basis. Our staff do receive ongoing fraud training and fraud detection and prevention so that we can prevent identity theft and deceptive practices in driver's licensing. Our support services program area provides customer information and record services and also supports the division operational needs, including plate production. We, in our public information center, we receive over 1 million phone calls on an annual basis. Approximately 250,000 of those are self-service calls that are operated through an interactive voice response system. And we also responded to about over 72,000 emails. We also assist the public, law enforcement, auto dealers, driver's license agents, and deputy registrars. And our special plate and disability unit issued 63,589 special license plates and over 91,000 disability parking certificates. We also administer the data practices and privacy policies and provide support for purchasing, printing, mail, and record retention needs. So those would be the major key areas within driver and vehicle services. And in addition to that, I would just want to mention, I know that I testified earlier or late in 2008 about our MNLARS program, and that's the Minnesota Licensing and Registration System project that we're working on to redesign our information system. And as the members that were on the committee in the last session know, we were fortunate to have the law enacted that allows us to collect a $1.75 technology surcharge on our transactions so that we would be able to pay for the system that we're beginning to work on the redesign of. I don't have a project plan available at this time, but hopefully we'll have one that we can share, a high-level project plan that we can share with the committee in the very near future. We are on target in terms of building cash that we need as we're planning this project, and the plan was that we would raise about $1 million each month for this project. The cost is anticipated over the 4 years to be about $48 million, and we're on target. As the end of December, we had raised about $6 million for the project. The goals of that project are to process and deliver services and integrate motor vehicle and driver license information, to re-engineer our business processes so that we can increase our day-to-day efficiency, increase data security, provide auditable transactions, and most especially, communicate with other information systems. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. McCormick. Last year, I guess the last couple of years, we've had a little bit of a hot potato in this committee in terms of the Get Your Stuff Back bill, the infamous towing bill. Many of you younger non-transportation types probably weren't in on that hearing, but we kind of discovered something as we went through this process, was that we had vehicles that were being purchased with license plates with maybe 6 to 8 months left on them, and at the end of that 6 to 8 months, or when the vehicle died, whichever occurred first, it was being left by the side of the road, at which point the county that was in charge or a private towing industry was supposed to come and pick up that vehicle. Then it was impounded, and then the people that owned the vehicle sort of went back to get their stuff out of the vehicle, but the people that owned the vehicle or that had towed the vehicle over there were trying to get their money back, weren't able to get that money back, and so they kept the vehicle as collateral. So all of that to say, the question brought forth the issue of the license plates, in that people are purchasing these vehicles without going through the registration process. They have not paid the tax on the vehicle. Those plates are really plates that should have been turned in, and then when the new plates are issued, a sales tax issued along with the new plates. Now, there are other states that actually, like California, that actually issue the plate when the vehicle is sold. They collect the old plates, the new title is issued, the new plates come with the vehicle. Is there some reason that we don't go to that model?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, I guess I may not have as much history on this issue. We do we request that people turn in their plates, and we send out notices of plate registration, you know, every 7 years in terms of, well, we send them out every year, but in terms of returning plates at the end of 7 years, because that's the life of the plate. But in terms of whether there's a transfer going on, I don't think that that's necessarily regulated in the sense that you're asking it to be. And so what you're saying is that's what you would think would be the recommendation, is that we would require that to be part of the sale, because I think our dealers do that as part of their operations. But if these are between customers, is what you're saying, between the buyer and the seller, where there isn't a dealer involved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Severson.
And Ms. McClung, that's correct. I think in terms of private parties when that transaction takes place, and this is where we're getting into the meat of the issue, that is, if the individual who has sold that car to another individual and that transfer is not taken place and recorded at the DVS, then that person who sold the vehicle is technically still really liable for that vehicle. And until that transfer takes place, if we gave some kind of impetus to the people that were selling the vehicle to say, look, if you don't turn that plate in other words, if you do this transaction, you sign over that title, and when you sign over that title, you have to take the plate off the vehicle and then turn that into DVS with a note that says you have transferred it to this particular individual, I think we could kind of take care of the situation in that they're going to drive around with a vehicle with no license plate on it. If they get stopped, you know, they can obviously show the receipt that says you've got 21 days or whatever to get those license plates, but it would also preclude, you know, it would force the individual seller to actually remove his liability by keeping the plates and then turning them in with the tickets, I think, with the registration. And this was some of the frustration that went with the last process, is what the state is losing out on a lot of money, but there's also liabilities in terms of the previous owners not going through the proper process, and we've left it up to the person who is buying the car to take the action. So we've left the person that is not, or that is selling the car, simply to sign it off, and that they lose their liability at that point, and then the person we're trusting that is buying the car is now going to go through the action, and they don't. And so that's where we lose out on a lot of the liability and the, and I'm sorry, in terms of the state collecting some of the sales tax fees and the new plates.
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, I think this is kind of some of the issue that Colonel Donaski also touched on, in terms of the fact that there is more fraud in terms of the plates and tabs and things like that, where they may not be. We do request that happen, but as you're saying, there's not enforcement of that law, and so what you're talking about is us more forcefully enforcing it. And certainly as we're re-engineering our business process, as we're redesigning our system, that would be something that we may be able to look at, but I can't really respond as to how we would do it at this point in time. Some of it is, I think that if we have more, one of the things that we need to ensure is that we're having much more accurate information, and I think that's part of our redesign of our system to attain that accuracy and data cleanup. And in addition to that, it may be that we're providing more updated information to law enforcement and to our deputy registrars, who also may need to be more involved in the process. So this is something I can look at and get back to the committee in a little more detail.
Just one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. And if you would, I think that process would be that if we notify the people that are selling the vehicle on that registration, change of registration, simply that you have to take the plates off the vehicle, turn them in with the registration change, that would force action on the issue. Just a suggestion, if there's some legislation that would need to come along with that to precipitate that, then maybe you could report back to the committee with that recommendation.
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, I know we do have some language, but it may not be strong enough, and so we will look at that and we will report back to the committee on that.
Representative Whale.
Thank you, Chair Leader. I am a high school English teacher, and my favorite age group is 16-year-olds, and I can't tell you how many times we've celebrated when a kid comes back to class saying, I just passed my driver's test. So thank you for coordinating all that joy out there in the world. The thing I wanted to ask about was your comment related to business efficiencies that you said that your department is working on. And I'm particularly interested in, I just had a meeting in my office last week with a gentleman who was telling me that at a lot of these small bureaus around the state, they collect the fees for the various transactions either using cash or checks. Many people, because of the financial situation they're in right now, will bounce the check. But the state comes in, collects the fee within 24 hours, but the bank doesn't notify the registration office that the check bounced until 3 days later. Who ends up holding the bag on that registration fee, and why doesn't this particular department or this, why isn't it possible to use credit cards and cash rather than a check?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wales, the department does allow cash transactions, so we do accept cash. And at this point in time, we have not allowed for the acceptance of credit cards. If we do allow for that acceptance, we need to ensure that all offices would be able to do that. We have a working group that the department had called together. We've been meeting since July. We have a report due in early February, and we are in the process of writing our report. We had our final meeting, but we still are drafting the report based on the last meeting. The issue is that we had this legislation has come up for the last several years, and the concern is that credit card companies will not, not all credit card companies will allow customers to pay the convenience fee that allows you to use a credit card. And because of the volume and the differences in amounts of money that we take in, for instance, a vehicle transaction could include sales tax as well as registration taxes, etc., that we would have to increase our fees a substantial amount to be able to pay the customer convenience fees that would be associated with the, with our estimates of that. The major credit card company in that's used in Minnesota is Visa, and we requested from Visa that Minnesota be able to serve as a pilot program for Visa to allow transactions with involving motor vehicle and driver licenses. So that we would be able to allow our customers to use credit cards and be able to pay whatever that amount would be for that transaction by the percentage that the credit card company charges, so that it would be a revenue neutral proposal. And just last week, Visa turned down our request and said that they would not allow us to do that. They are not interested in pursuing driver and motor vehicle agencies allowing that service. MasterCard and Discover and American Express have all said that we would be able to do that. So we will be putting our recommendations and options together for the Senate and House Transportation Committees to review to see what the next steps would be. the proposal that was in last year's policy bill stated that we would come forward with these options, lay them out to the committee, and see if we would be, if the committees would look at directing the department to come up with some kind of an RFP regarding some kind of system that would allow for credit cards. So we should be able to discuss that at some further meeting. We should have it available for you in early February. But that's the main reason why we aren't offering them.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, real quickly, I'd just like to follow up with
that. Oh, okay.
The first portion of my question, though, was the it takes 3 days for the bank to notify your offices that a check bounced. But the state has come in within the first 24 hours and taken the money that it needs for, you know, what is required by statute. So after the bank says this person defaulted on this check, what happens?
Can you give us a brief explanation?
Mr. Chair and Representative Swales, my understanding, because we do have the Department of Management and Budget at our credit card working groups, is that in general they don't come in and take the money the first day. That it's usually between 1 and 3 days, and many of our deputy registrars have told us that oftentimes it could be 3 to 4 days when they take the money. But the contract with the banks does allow them to sweep that first day. So it really is not a contract with DVS. It is a contract on behalf of the state in terms of the banking provisions, and it's really an accounting process that the state uses. It really has nothing to do with us. So it's just practice that's required of anybody that's collecting state fees and taxes. So,
Representative Hausman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up a little bit on that. I confess I'm one of those that has had just a huge amount of frustration and confusion about why this department has needed so long, because, I mean, you have the sense you can go just about anywhere and use the credit cards now. And, I mean, DNR somehow has, even with their probably the same challenges relative to computers. And the one that particularly confused me is there was one office so frustrated in their inability to provide good customer service that they did a lot of this research and negotiating on their own and thought they had figured it all out, and even I think had a letter from the Attorney General, but didn't have the freedom to go ahead with that with their own negotiation. So I think it's the long period of time that it's seeming to take to resolve what is an issue like that, where the rest of the world seems to have figured something out. So that's really just a level of frustration on this particular issue. And then the other is this whole issue of the timing of the whole when you sell your car and. It requires the seller to do something that really totally takes the buyer off the hook. And I know we have discussed this many times. I think there have been bills on this, but we still haven't figured out how do we protect that seller from whatever might happen to that car after it leaves their hands.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, I think that, yeah, I know we've talked about this issue for quite some time, and that's why I think it is something that we have talked about internally in terms of looking at how we could re-engineer the business process. My hope would be that if we do have a information system that does communicate with other information systems, which our current one does not electronically communicate with them, that may be helpful. That is not the case right now, but I do think that I would like to explore that a little bit more with our vehicle services project manager and see what they might be able to do, and I will report back to you, because we understand we spend a lot of time trying to explain it or trace where there could have been a problem when people call us regarding those same issues. So we certainly understand the frustration with that.
Thank you.
And we will try to, as I said, on the credit card issue, I know it has been a long time coming, and because it involves so much revenue, that has been one of the sticking points in terms of the discussion, in terms of how we would pay for it if we would allow all credit cards to be used. So I think we'll try to lay out some options for the committee to consider and see where we can go from there.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, it seems to me that if I sell my car, I can go online and register and at least just put in there, and I think I've done it. It takes like 20 seconds to go in and say, here's my VIN, or here's my license number, and then I've sold the vehicle. And basically, that's all I have to do. And I think that relieves me of the responsibility and or the liability if something would happen with that vehicle, because if I don't do that and there's a crash, obviously, isn't that right? So isn't there already something in place that I can just go online and register my plate and say I sold it, and I'm kind of off the hook in terms of liability at that point?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer, that is correct, that we do have that. But I also understand what Representative Severson and Representative Hausman are talking about, because not everyone has that access to the Internet, and that's what we hear quite often, is that they just didn't get around to it. But we also have these fraudulent transactions that may have occurred as well, where they're taking a plate off and putting it on another vehicle, and then you as the previous owner may be caught up in that problem. And so I think that we have tried to address it. The issue is it hasn't addressed the problem entirely, and so that's the concern. But I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you.
Ms. McCormick, you indicated you had 63,000 roughly plates that you issued, and according to statute, now you've spoken about some of your other sections or divisions, you can make some money, not make some money, but you can at least recover your cost or get a fee. But on making a motor vehicle license plate, you can't even make a penny. Now we change that, and if you're issuing that many plates, wouldn't it feel reasonable that we should be able to, as any other department or any other function, at least recover the cost of the plate? I don't even think you're recovering the cost of the plate when you look at it, which the statute says you should. I mean, you're only getting the cost of the plate, but there's other extraneous cost by the time you get that plate. And I think you're just getting the cost of the manufacture of the plate itself. Is that correct? Could you use a little more money? I guess that's what I'm saying.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think right now we're estimating our costs for this fiscal year to be approximately about $6.6 million. And so we do have a little additional money. We can only use it if we have those expenses in the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund that we use for that plate fund. But in general, we try, the only times that it can be a problem, especially would be if material costs go up. We had to revise our numbers last year because of the additional costs involved with the steel that was used for the plates. But I think, you know, obviously the volume makes a difference. We're a volume-based business, but we try to estimate our costs. And for every biennial budget, we try to estimate what those costs would be and then provide that information to the legislature. And, of course, right now the governor has not introduced his budget as of yet, but in terms of what we've estimated for this current year, I think our numbers are within what we are getting, what we think we'll be needing to produce, looking at our early estimates in this.
Ms. McCormick, when you issue a title card or a driver's license, you recover a little bit more than what the cost of that individual sheet of paper and stuff is. Why can't you do that on license? A question I'm asking now, why can't you? I know you can't. It's not in the statute. But it used to be in the statute prior to, what, 6, 8 years ago? And that's the question, because technically the issuance by the registrars, they can make money on it to some degree, and you can't recover anything over and above the cost of the plate. And I guess that's, I don't know another department in the state that isn't retrieving some money on fees, because we see that's the way that the last couple of sessions we've been able to fund some of the departments is by the increase in fees. Wouldn't that appear to be reasonable? I suppose you can't say. And you know, it's something we should look at, because there are an awful lot of plates, and it certainly seems reasonable that if someone, you have to pay for the administration of it. If you're not getting it out of the general fund or anything else, and you aren't, you're actually taking it out of somewhere else. It's something we should look at, and I think we certainly would. Any further questions from Ms. McCormick? If not, I'd like to ask the
just one quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mr. McCormick, a couple of years ago, we put into effect that the plates could go to the dealers, so the dealers could issue the plates for a $20 additional fee. Has that program been successful, unsuccessful, non-existent?
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, that's our electronic vehicle registration program, and while the law went into effect a couple of years ago, we just really began implementing it because of technical problems with trying to implement it this past year. And so there are many dealerships that are using that system, and but we're still in the process of getting it ramped up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you.
Commissioner, could you come back to the podium? Appreciate it. Just going to ask a few questions. On this real ID, there's some federal monies available that you have to apply for by the time of the end of February. Is that correct?
You're correct. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
You in the process of applying for those or not? Was that Ms. McCormick's area? I didn't know.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there's a grant through FEMA that was entitled the Real ID Grant. I'm not sure if that still is the name or not, but the goal of that grant is for enhancing driver license security, and the program through Department of Homeland Security has just been renamed to be called, rather than the Real ID program, the Driver License Security Enhancement Program. And so the states that apply for that grant do not have to be implementing the Real ID Act. The grant requirements involve that you would use the dollars to enhance the security of your driver license issuing system in some way, and that would be how the goals of whatever project you are requesting funding of.
That's the question I was going to ask. If you're applying, and we've got a problem with the passage of the Real ID anyhow, but at least you could use that money to maybe implement or supplement for your computer system? Would that be your intention? Are you going to apply, do you believe, or not?
Mr. Chair, it is our intention that we will be applying, and we would be using it basically for data cleanup. One of the major things when you're implementing a new information system that we've heard in discussions with other state DMVs is that one of the main things you need to look at early on in the process is data cleanup, because it does no good to implement a new system technologically without having data that already is accurate, so that those transactions will be able to be processed with using a new system. And so that has been our intention, and certainly we would keep the committee advised. I had received an email from Corinne, and I hadn't gotten back to her yet, so I apologize for that. But we will certainly keep you
up to date. I have to meet with staff later this week on that planning for that grant application.
You received a grant prior a couple months ago. Did you use that? How did you use that money?
Mr. Chair, the money that we received, we have used to allow for staffing so that the facial recognition process that we had a grant from Federal Motor Carrier that allowed us to look at all of our driver license photos and ensure that we don't have duplicates, that there is not any fraud involved. And so what we've done is we have used the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration grant for that one-time look at all of our photos, and now the grant that we got this last year, we are using to pay for the staffing that we need to review anywhere where we did find matches, to follow up and ensure that we are investigating any cases where there have been duplicate photos, that we need to ensure that there was not any fraud involved, and it also, that way, will also help us in cleaning our driver license photo database up.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. We have Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, we had discussed, had a phone conversation with you about that program that you were just talking about, and I just need clarification. Were you saying it's just a one-time process where you take a look at all of the driver's licenses, or is this actually technologies that you're putting in place that the state of Minnesota can use on an ongoing basis?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, we do not have the funding available to put in the technology that we would need to do it on an ongoing basis, so we thought this would at least be helpful for us to clean up our current database.
Representative Welty.
Thank you. Follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Just one question, and that is, how much would it cost for the state of Minnesota to implement that technology or to purchase it so we have it available?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, we did an estimate a couple of years ago, and I would need to review that and get back to the committee. I'll get back to you. I'm not sure. I wouldn't want to give you the wrong amount, so I'll check it out and get back to you.
Representative Mason?
I just want to clarify the discussion that you were having. You are able to take federal grants to use to help with our driver's license, but it does not actually tie the state to the Real ID project. Is that correct?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, it is correct because the Department of Homeland Security met with several governors that were representing the National Governors Association, and it was determined that there were many states that would not be allowed to participate in this grant program because they were not allowed under their state laws to be able to implement the Real ID Act, and so the Department of Homeland Security revised the grant application requirements and said that you did not have to sign or state in your grant that you would be implementing the Real ID Act.
Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you, Commissioner and Ms. McCormick.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And the next meeting is, we have a joint meeting on Thursday with the three other committees, and that's in room in the big
200,
room 200, and that's a joint meeting on the Northwest Delta merger. So you'll probably have to get there early to get a seat because there'll be a lot of people.
Members.
60 members will be there.
50 members.
22nd?
Yeah, so. And the next meeting is Thursday at the same time at 4:30 in room 200. Meeting adjourned.